Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I would like now to welcome Adam Skaggs. He is the lawyer with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And we're here to talk today about voting issues of all kinds, from voter registration to voter list purges, voter ID, voting machines. This is something that the Brennan Center for Justice is really focusing on. Tell us a little bit about the Brennan Center, first of all.
Well, that's right. We're focusing on a range of these areas. The Brennan Center is kind of a part policy think tank, part public policy advocacy center, and part public interest law firm. We study these issues and advocate for reforms relating to, among other things, voter participation and registration processes. And occasionally, we get involved in litigation challenging policies that we feel unconstitutionally burden the right to vote for eligible American citizens. So we do a range of stuff in addition to voting, but that's the area that I work in.
So voter registration has been very heavy this year. It seems that there have been more voter registrations than ever. Is that true?
Well, we really have seen just an unprecedented surge in the interest in participating in the election this year. Obviously, the country is facing a number of important issues, both at home and abroad. And I think, millions of Americans are expressing their interest in voting for the first time. You've seen early voting in a number of states across the country that has just seen unprecedented turnout. And I think that all signs point to this being an election in which we see participation by groups and individuals that have just never participated before. So that's exactly right. There is a huge level of new registration and a huge level of interest throughout the country.
At the same time, there's been a backlash and an attempt to suppress voter registration or to, for example, if there are even the tiniest typos between a person's voter registration and another identification, then their registration is invalidated.
Well, that's exactly right. And that works in two ways. In some states, under some policies and laws, it works to keep people from registering in the first place. In other states, they're using questionable methods and procedures to actually kick people off the voter rolls. So folks that are already registered are being kicked off, usually without being given any notice. And what's happening with them is they're showing up at the polls and being told, sorry, your name doesn't appear on the list. This is not the first time we've seen this sort of problem. These sorts of issues have always taken place to some degree or another in elections. But we really are seeing an unprecedented amount of obstacles being erected in front of voters that are keeping them, unfortunately, in many cases, from getting onto the voter rolls.
So suppose somebody is a registered voter, they're on the voter rolls, and then their name is purged and they go to early vote. Have there been cases where people say, I'm a registered voter, put me back on, and because it's still 2 weeks before Election Day, they can get reinstated?
Well, I haven't heard specifically of any particular incidents along those lines, which is not to say it hasn't happened. I'm just not aware of it. But I would say that early voting provides a great opportunity to avoid long lines on Election Day, but also to iron out any difficulties that may have arisen along the lines that you suggest. Even in states where early voting is not a viable option for a voter, you can sort of do the same sort of thing by just calling your local or your county election officials and just checking to make sure that your registration status is totally up to speed and there are no question marks surrounding it. Obviously, it's easier to resolve these situations if you begin investigating them long before the election rather than on Election Day itself. Just gives you more time to sort out any problems that may have occurred. So I would encourage folks to either try an early vote, try and contact your election officials beforehand if you have to. And I would suggest that anyone who discovers there's any sort of a problem with their registration, either before Election Day or on Election Day itself, the first thing that that person should do is call the Election Protection Hotline. There's a group called Election Protection. It's actually a coalition of different groups, the Brennan Center being one of them, that works to help voters who encounter difficulties. And so call them up. Their number is 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 866-OUR-VOTE. And they will, 9 times out of 10, be able to give you the directions and instructions you need to resolve whatever that problem is. I would say that particularly if you encounter a problem at the polls on election day rather than before, it's very important that the most fundamental thing is you don't leave that polling place without casting a ballot. Don't walk away from the polls because of confusion, because of something a polling worker is telling you, without casting a ballot. Now, you may be forced to vote a provisional ballot. If your name is not appearing on the list for whatever reason, they may deny you a regular traditional ballot and give you what's called a provisional ballot. It's a sort of a fail-safe ballot that you give a voter if there's any question about their registration. So at the very least, federal law gives you the right to vote that provisional ballot. But it's an imperfect solution, voting a provisional ballot. Sometimes you have to take extra steps to make sure it gets counted. And because of those reasons, obviously, voting a regular ballot is far preferable, and voters should do everything they can to make sure they get one.
We're talking to Adam Skaggs from the Brennan Center for Justice about voting. You mentioned that there are various obstructions that are being put in the way of people being able to cast a ballot. What are some of the other obstructions, and who's behind them?
Well, you know, you mentioned one of the problems that's arising with attempting to match voters' data that they write on their voter applications with other government records, and people being blocked from the voter rolls because of a typo. That's an important one. One of the states that has the most strict policies along those lines, which we refer to as the no match, no vote policy, is Florida. Florida has had this policy in place for a couple of years. The Brennan Center and some other groups actually sued them last year, and we had that law struck down by a federal judge before the presidential primary earlier this year. That law was keeping 16,000 people off the voter rolls because of typos, data entry errors, and other common mistakes that occur between databases, like, for example, somebody registering to vote in their married name when their driver's license was in their maiden name, something like that. So again, 16,000 people were kept off the rolls by the law until it was struck down, and they could then vote in the presidential primary. The state, because that law had been struck down, didn't have an opportunity to reapply the law until just a few weeks ago. The state legislature went back, tweaked the law a little bit, and they decided to start implementing that on September 8th of this year, just 4 weeks before the registration books closed in Florida. In those 4 weeks, already 12,000 people, that's about 3,000 people per week, were blocked, and they are currently not eligible to vote a regular ballot in Florida because of these sorts of typos. You can imagine if the state had enforced this law for more than just those last 4 weeks of registration, with those kind of numbers, we'd be talking many, many more thousands of voters. But even so, in 4 weeks, they blocked 12,000 for these sorts of typos. So that's a real problem. We're working with a number of groups in Florida to resolve it, but it's obviously a concern.
Is it the kind of typo if my name is Ann and I spell it with an E and on the other record is just A-N-N, I would be ineligible to vote?
Well, that's basically the type of problem we're talking about, yes. It's not necessarily true you'd be ineligible to vote because you might be able to resolve it by following up with election officials beforehand.
Well, do they notify you? In other words, let's say you're purged from the because of a no-match situation. Do they write a letter to your home saying you've been taken off the voter list?
Well, the law says they do have to provide that kind of notice. What we're finding, talking to some of these 12,000 voters that are on the list, is that they're just not getting those notices. Now, it may be because they made the same kind of typo in the person's address and they sent the notice to the wrong to the wrong address. It may be because this thing got lost in the mail. You know, there are probably voters that the envelope got delivered, but they just discarded it, you know, for whatever reason. So what we're finding is that folks don't always get the notice, and even when they do, they don't understand exactly what it means and what they have to do. But that's exactly the kind of typo that causes this problem. And as I said, the state has actually, to their credit, been very careful about reviewing these. Originally, they had more than 60,000 no matches, And they went through them carefully, and they realized that in two-thirds of those, there was a typo like the type you talked about, typing "and" with or without an E. So they resolved most of them, but still there are 12,000 people that are blocked from the rolls. So that's a problem in Florida. You've seen litigation in another couple of swing states in Ohio and in Wisconsin, where certain groups have sued to try and prevent people with these sort of mismatches from voting. In Ohio alone, that would have been up to 200,000 voters who might have been disenfranchised or at least had their odds of being able to successfully cast a ballot reduced greatly because of these sorts of typos. That's obviously cause for concern, but that's not the only kind of, gotcha policy that's preventing voters from registering voting. In Colorado right now, the Secretary of State has enforced a policy that if a voter failed to check a checkbox on their voter application, then they wouldn't be registered. Now, on the Colorado application, there's a place where you can write your driver's license number if you have a driver's license. And if you don't, you can write a you can write four digits of your Social Security number. Now, on the form, if you write your Social Security number down, you're supposed to put a check in the box next to it that says, "I'm giving you my Social Security number." Now, presumably, there are voters out there. In fact, there are thousands of voters that said, "Well, I just wrote my number down. Why would I have to check the box to tell you the number's there? Obviously, I provided the number." So they didn't check this sort of unnecessary box. But unfortunately, the Colorado Secretary of State has said that under the law, people are required to put a check in that box and has rejected thousands of voter applications. The Secretary of State of Ohio tried a similar policy and was rejecting requests for absentee ballots. That, again, there was a check box that was completely unnecessary. Several thousand voters didn't check it, and the Secretary of State of Ohio was originally going to deny them absentee ballots. A court, thankfully, ordered that those absentee ballots be distributed and that this missing checkbox was not a legitimate justification for denying somebody a ballot. But unfortunately, this is the kind of thing that we're seeing all over the country, these small issues that have nothing to do with voters' qualifications, but that are being used to stop voters either from registering or from getting a ballot that they request. So it's very unfortunate.
So you talk about these problems in Florida and Ohio and Wisconsin. Is this a partisan issue? Who is behind the movements to try to deny people their right to vote?
Well, unfortunately, in many cases, it is appearing as a partisan issue. The checkbox example I just used, I would point out that the secretary in Ohio is a Democrat and the secretary in Colorado is a Republican. So it's not to say that it's one party or the other. Neither party has a monopoly on voter suppression and on erecting barriers to vote. That said, we are seeing these sorts of policies in swing states. In states that are very clearly red or very clearly blue, for some reason, the concerns that caused these officials to pursue these policies in the swing states, I guess they don't care about those things as much in the states that aren't particularly competitive, because where we're seeing these are states that are very competitive. And you really see two sides of the electoral equation. On the one hand, you see really surging voter registration activity. You see many, many thousands of new voters being brought into the process. And on the other hand, the other side of the equation is an attempt to stop as many of these new voters as possible from voting. And all too often, these sorts of policies that I'm talking about are aimed exclusively at new voters. Now, we have all seen the statistics of the voter registration figures from the two parties this year. And a huge percentage of that voter registration activity is among new Democratic voters. So if you are pursuing these policies in the swing states that are exclusively impacting new voters who are disproportionately Democratic, you can guess what the impact of these policies is going to be. Again, neither party has a monopoly on voter suppression or erecting barriers to voting, but there are some pretty clear patterns emerging in this election cycle.
We're talking to Adam Skaggs, lawyer with the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. In past elections, we've had other voting list purges where thousands, tens of thousands of people's names have been purged through private contractors have been hired to go through lists and purge what are considered ineligible voters. How has that been dealt with, if it has, in the 2008 election?
Well, that's an ongoing problem. As you say, you said tens of thousands. Actually, millions and millions of voters are removed every year from the voter rolls. The Brennan Center, just released a study, which is available if anyone would like to download it from our website, which is brennancenter.org, on voter purges. And one of the things we discovered in that report is that between 2004 and 2006, 13 million voters were kicked off the registration rolls. That's 13 million names taken off the rolls in just a two-year period. Now, many of those voters were removed properly, and obviously it's very important to take voters off the registration rolls when they die or when they move out of state, or in many states, at least when they're convicted of felonies. So it's very important that these voter rolls are maintained accurately, and trimming the dead wood, if you will, off of the voter rolls is important to ensure that they're accurate. But that said, all too often these voter purge activities are taking place with little supervision, with no transparency, sort of in secret. And because that's the way they're conducted, there's really no way to ensure that they're not making mistakes, either for partisan reasons or just simply from sloppy bureaucratic practices that are resulting in eligible voters being kicked off the voter registration rolls. In our report, we saw just countless examples of either, again, bureaucratic, let's say, lack of quality control, or actually partisan mischief that has resulted in some cases, hundreds, in some cases, thousands, in some cases, tens of thousands of voters who are kicked off, often just before the primary elections or just before elections, often without being discovered until after Election Day, when all these voters show up to vote and find out there's a problem.
How are these lists and databases maintained? In other words, who is responsible for them on a bureaucratic level? And is there any, it sounds like there's no regulation at all on how that maintenance is done.
Well, there is regulation both at the state and the federal level. There are federal laws, for example, that prohibit undertaking any sort of systematic purges within 90 days of an election, but unfortunately what we saw and what this study describes is that those laws aren't always followed. And in some cases, election officials make some arguments about why they were technically in compliance with the law when it really doesn't look like that's actually the case. You asked about who maintains these databases, and it's sort of a dual role between local and sometimes county officials as well as state officials. And part of the reason that some of these purge practices are enabled and end up taking place is because sometimes there's not clear authority for whose final responsibility it is to either keep the rolls accurate or make sure that voters aren't wrongly taken off of them. I should say that every state now, with the exception of North Dakota, which actually does not register voters, it's the only state that that's true of, every state now has a statewide voter list. These statewide voter databases were mandated by a law that Congress passed in 2002. It's called the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, H-A-V-A. And HAVA mandated that every state develop a central computerized statewide database. Before that, in many states, there were hundreds of thousands of different voter lists in towns and counties. And it's been really a step in the right direction to develop these central databases. Among other reasons, it prevents, for example, a voter from being registered in two cities in the same state, and that sort of thing. So that's been a step in the right direction. But unfortunately, computerizing all of this and putting it in one place has also opened the door to some of the purge practices that we were just talking about. Obviously, with every name in one place on one list, with a couple of keystrokes on a computer, you can delete thousands of voters. In the past, that wouldn't have been possible. We saw one example during the primary season earlier this year where in Mississippi, an election official went home, logged onto her home computer, not even from her office, and purged almost 10,000 voters from the rolls in that particular community just before the primary. Now, thankfully, that came to light, and that was unlawful, and that was stopped. But the computerization of all these records has resolved a lot of problems that existed, but unfortunately it's also opened the door up to some new problems.
There have been some examples of intimidation of voters and voter registration, for example, on college campuses, where administrators have said that if a student registers to vote in the state where the college is, then their parents can no longer claim them as a dependent, which turned out not to be true at all. Tell us about some of these examples and how they've been addressed.
Well, that's exactly right. We've seen reports of student, I don't know if you'd want to call it misinformation or intimidation, but certainly inaccurate information being told to students with the intention of discouraging them from registering to vote. Virginia has seen a huge amount of that. Again, we see Virginia, another hotly contested swing state, that all of a sudden young voters who, again, generally have trended to vote for one particular party, young voters have been targeted with this misinformation that says, as you say, your parents won't be able to claim you as a dependent, or they've even sent messages out saying that you're going to lose your financial aid if you register here, all these kinds of things. Every time one of those false messages has gone out, we have seen a number of different voting rights advocates and various groups weighing in and saying, "Oh, that's not accurate." Forcing oftentimes the election officials or partisan groups that have been putting these messages out, forcing them to retract those statements. But of course, sometimes the damage is done. A student doesn't hear the correction, and they've already decided, "Wow, I better not vote." So that's a big concern. But it's not just students that are the targets of this sort of intimidation or misinformation. You've seen urban communities, a number of different cities, where anonymous flyers have been posted saying that if you have any unpaid parking tickets, you'll be arrested if you try and vote. And this is simply not true. Nobody's arrested because they didn't pay a parking ticket and they try and vote. But you've seen these sorts of misinformation, intimidation, that are aimed simply to stop voters from showing up at the polls and to scare them away. And again, unfortunately, we've seen these targeted towards specific communities, and in many cases, these are communities that at least are assumed to primarily vote Democratic.
What specific communities are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about students. I'm talking about the African-American community. Some of this has been targeted towards African-American communities in Philadelphia, some of these flyers I've talked about. It's part and parcel of the same trends that I was discussing earlier with restrictions on allowing voters to register. The bottom line is that with all of these things, either stopping voters from getting on the rolls and registering in the first place, kicking them off once they are registered, intimidating them and scaring them away from showing up at the polls. All of these are efforts or attempts to reduce voter turnout. And as I said, generally they're always targeted at groups, new voters, students, African-Americans that are thought to be more likely to vote Democratic. This is an upsetting trend that we've seen this year, but I suppose it shouldn't be surprising given that the surge in registration activity has promised to bring so many new voters into the process.
Well, it's also not surprising based on the last two presidential elections.
Well, that's exactly right. Our elections have become so close, and the margins particularly, we've seen in the past two elections, we've seen incredibly razor-thin margins in a number of states. New Mexico was decided, people may not recall, but back in 2000, New Mexico was decided by less than 400 votes.
Right.
About 366 votes, that was the difference in the presidential election. And there were four states that year in 2000 that had final margins less than 7,000 difference. I mean, that is a tiny number of votes. In 2004, it was slightly more, but four states in 2004 had close margins that were less than 12,000 votes. New Mexico, again, was one of those states. So you have a number of particularly these swing states, these very closely fought races being decided by hundreds, if not thousands, of votes. And when the elections are that close, there are basically two ways to win. One is to excite the base and sign up more voters and bring voters in and get more people to vote for your candidates or for your ideas. And the other is to fight that and try and stop those people from voting, to try and reduce the number that your opponent can get. And unfortunately, we're seeing both of those strategies played out in this election.
And one of them is perfectly legal and ethical, and the other one isn't.
Well, you know, I'm not going to disagree with you. Unfortunately, leaving ethics aside, some of the legality of these practices is unfortunately these haven't been outlawed. Now, certainly, voter intimidation, voter misinformation, threatening voters. You've seen private investigators walking around New Mexico harassing voters and threatening them. That they're going to try and stop them from voting.
Even in early voting.
That's exactly right. And those sorts of things are illegal. But unfortunately, some of these policies and some of the purge practices also end up violating federal law. But some of the registration policies I've talked about, making it difficult for people to register if they don't have, an exact match. Some of these policies are being passed by the legislatures of various states. These are misguided policies. They have only the effect of stopping people from coming out and voting, and that is not a legitimate purpose. But unfortunately, some of these are actually enshrined in the laws of various states.
We're talking to Adam Skaggs, who is with the Brennan Center for Justice in New York at the New York University School of Law. Let's talk about voting machines. We've already seen in early voting some electronic touchscreen voting machines in which, in a repeat of 2004, people touch the screen to vote for Obama and the little check mark lights up under McCain. What kind of problems like this have you been observing or hearing reports of?
Well, as you said, it kind of feels like here we go all over again with history, some of these reports. Fortunately, while I have heard some of those stories of so-called vote flipping from one candidate to the next, they seem to, at least in early voting, have been few and far between. The initial glitches that we have seen have been corrected by calibrating the machines. And we are hopeful, certainly, that as we go forward through Election Day in a week or so, that these will be minimized. Voters, if they ever encounter that kind of problem, should speak up immediately. They should obviously talk to the poll workers. They should call the Election Protection Hotline to alert them to the problem. That's 866-OUR-VOTE. Call that up and let them know there's a problem. And what's most important is when they get to the final screen of their ballot with these electronic machines, you sort of go from screen to screen as you would an ATM machine at a bank, and you finally get to the end screen, and that should give you a summary of everything. And that's the screen that voters have to check most carefully, because if you get to that last screen and you realize the wrong box is checked, you need to go back and you need to start over. Those sorts of problems hopefully can be minimized, and certainly voters, to the extent they want to proofread them very carefully, should be able to ensure that those are minimized. Some of the other problems that we've seen with some of the voting machines and the ballot designs are in situations where voters simply don't have an opportunity at the end to go back and realize that there's been a mistake made. For example, there's been a lot of discussion recently in the past couple of days of problems with early voting in North Carolina, where there is what's called undervoting happening in the presidential race. That is, a lot of people are filling out their ballots and casting a vote for Congress, maybe for mayor in their town, maybe for the U.S. Senate race, but actually not voting for president. And you would assume that would be a very rare occurrence. Most people, if they're going to vote in one race at all, are certainly going to vote for president. What we've seen is that there's a button you can press in North Carolina that gives you a straight party line vote. So if you know that you want to vote for every Republican candidate or every Democratic candidate, you don't have to check five different boxes for each race. You can just check party line vote. The problem is that in North Carolina, you also have to check the president separately. For whatever reason, the way they designed the ballot, that party line vote gives you a vote for, say, the Democratic slate or the Republican slate in every race except president. And many voters are going in saying, oh, party line, I'll just check that, and assuming that's going to cast a ballot for president, and ultimately having submitted their ballot without voting for president. So there are these sorts of technological glitches, whether it's a matter of the machines not functioning exactly right, whether it's a matter of the memory cards in the machines being uploaded at the end of the night and having discrepancies between the number of votes that are recorded and the number of ballots cast, or whether it's issues with the design of the ballots themselves that confuse or mislead voters. We have seen just, unfortunately, a number of issues that that have cropped up in early voting, and I'm sure we'll see these at least in isolated instances on Election Day itself.
Going back to the question of touchscreen voting machines and other voting machine problems, you said that you hope that the problems are minimized, but, you know, hope is one of those things that is kind of a thin protection when there is not, when there's really pretty much corporate ownership of the machines, the software, and the counting of the votes, and the actual public officials in charge of voting are not the ones doing it.
Well, I think you raise a very good point there, and I think that in terms of long-term solutions, we need to get away from that. There needs to be transparency, both in the way the machines are designed and in the way the votes are tallied. I couldn't agree more. I think that, however, when I say we have to hope that the incidents are minimized, I don't mean to say that kind of we should put our hands over our eyes and, you know, and bury our head in the sand and just hope for the best. That is certainly not what I'm saying. We certainly want there to be as few problems as there have to be. Obviously, I think everyone agrees with that. But there are going to be problems, and when we see problems, when they do emerge, we can't just hope that somebody else will fix them. We have to address them head on. And individual voters, when they encounter problems, have to call the number I gave before, 866-OUR-VOTE, Election Protection, so that the people there can get involved and troubleshoot and resolve some of these problems. One thing I feel I can predict with confidence in this election. I don't know who's going to win. I don't know where the problems are going to be. I won't give you a prediction on any of that, but what I will predict is that you're going to see more lawyers on the ground from both campaigns, from nonpartisan groups like Election Protection, who are watching polling places across the country. They're going to be out at the polls. They're going to be observing and ready to confront any misconduct that occurs or any problems that crop up. And they're going to be back in sort of war rooms monitoring the situation and ready to fly out to wherever they need to go.
We're talking to Adam Skaggs, lawyer with the Brennan Center for Justice. The question of machine testing and whether or not there are any standards is something that has come up in the state of New Mexico, where our optical scan machines were tested recently, and it turned out that if you voted straight party, they weren't registering the votes properly, and the machines were fixed. But it does lead to the question, who's responsible for testing, and are there airtight standards that are enforced for testing voting machines?
Well, unfortunately, the answer to that is that it varies from state to state. And some states, to their credit, have really excellent protocols in place and are addressing some of those issues very well. Unfortunately, in other states, the preparations have been less effective. But that's not just an issue with respect to the machines that are being used. And, of course, in a number of places around the country, the machines that are being used for the first time. So that obviously opens up the door not only to glitches and problems with the performance of the machines, but also voter confusion, voters not being sure exactly if they're filling things out properly. And again, this gets back to confusing and unfamiliar ballot design. But this lack of standards as far as quality control is a problem not only with the machines and how they sort of interface with the voters so that the voters can actually make sure their vote is recorded properly, but with the vote counting, which is obviously, for obvious reasons, an incredibly important part of the process. Wherever we have seen over history, wherever we have seen fraud being introduced into the election cycle, it's not individual voters sneaking in and trying to pretend they're a voter who died. There's no evidence that those things happen with any sort of systemic frequency. What we do see is manipulating the vote counting. And whether that's the old-fashioned way of stuffing fake ballots in ballot boxes back at election headquarters when they're being counted, or whether it's more sophisticated ways that involve the computers we're using today, that's a real area of concern. And again, we have a number of states that have put into place very, very detailed and very careful procedures for calibrating these counts and for then going back and auditing the counts after the election day to make sure that, that in fact, everything was done very accurately. But unfortunately, again, in other states, their marks are not as high. They're not scoring as well on their preparedness for that.
Well, for example, in New Mexico, we have switched to paper ballots with optical scan machines. Optical scan machines are, in theory, capable of being hacked, of being reprogrammed, and so on. And I believe there's not a provision that elections be randomly audited. So they'll just count by hand a certain number of votes in any given precinct to see if they match the outcomes of the optical scan machine counts.
Well, and that, I think you put your finger on a really important thing, and that's the post-election audit. And that's, again, some states have actually been pretty effective in putting in measures to make sure that that happens. But that's incredibly important because, obviously, to the extent any problems do emerge in the vote counting, those can be detected and caught during these audits, and then any mistakes that are made can be corrected. I think what all these issues that we're talking about, whether the technology in which votes are cast, the methods by which votes are counted, or even the process by which voters register and then are able to vote, we've just discussed a huge, wide-ranging set of issues and problems that are facing the system. And I think, if anything, that all these problems that we're discussing today make very clear that there's systemic reform that needs to happen. After 2000, you saw Congress attempting to grapple with some of these issues, and unfortunately, there was a lot of partisan compromises, so the solutions that they did come up with took a few steps forward, but they didn't go, in my estimation, far enough to resolve a lot of the problems that we're now seeing still persisting. So I think there are systemic reforms that need to be made, both with technology as well as the voter registration process. Some of these can be accomplished at the state level. Certainly states should not sit around and wait for Congress and the feds to resolve these. But ultimately, a federal solution to a number of these concerns would certainly be a desirable outcome. So I think if there's any positive, if there's anything good to be taken from all the problems that we've seen in the past months and certainly in these past days and weeks leading right up to the election, it's that there is certainly awareness. Policymakers really have no way not to be aware of the concerns and the problems that are facing the country. And with any luck, they will take these seriously and they will try and address some meaningful change in these areas. Now, the country faces a lot of concerns right now, whether we're talking about wars abroad or the economy at home. Obviously, there are a number of serious concerns. So, we will have to be vigilant. Groups that work with voters and groups that work to reform elections will have to be vigilant after the election to make sure that we don't just forget about these concerns with our voting system, which really, after all, is fundamental to our democracy. It's really the fabric of our democracy. And we're going to have to work real hard to make sure that the problems that have been exposed don't just get forgotten until all of a sudden 4 years from now or 2 years from now we see the same problems playing out.
Well, I mean, yes, but, one can argue that this has been going on since the year, well, obviously it's been going on for centuries, but it's been going on since the year 2000. One could argue that the 2000 election was stolen, and one could argue that the 2004 election was stolen. If you look closely at some of the issues in Ohio, the Democratic Party has not stepped up to the plate in general, and the media really have not stepped up to the plate to the point where Acorn is far better known than voter purges.
Well, I certainly take your point, and I certainly would agree that it's a real disappointment that after all the problems we saw in 2000, there hasn't been more and faster and more effective movement to reform this process. And I agree it's a disappointment that we're sitting here and seeing these problems, some of which we've seen before, many of which we've seen before, just seeming to repeat themselves. But I do think there is a possibility for change this time around. I think that by and large, we hear about the problems facing elections more than we hear about the places where the elections run smoothly. There are places in America where people line up. They don't have to wait in line for hours. They cast their ballot on a machine that works and records their vote properly. And, in fact, that happens most places. By and large, the system is a good one. It's just one that obviously needs reforms and needs significant reforms. But, you know, I think we shouldn't approach this election, at least I don't approach this election thinking that the outcome is going to be automatically suspect and that there are so many problems that the system can't be trusted. I personally don't think that is the case. I think there are real problems. I don't think we should, be naive about them or pretend they aren't there. But I think that we've got basically at the bottom a sound system that most Americans are proud of and that many times works pretty well. And that what our job is to make sure that the remaining issues that there are get ironed out so that we have a system that works for everybody, and that these unfortunate problems we've just been talking about don't happen.
You mentioned the length of lines, and in many places, I mean, I've voted many times in Santa Fe where I didn't stand in the line for more than a few minutes, but there is definitely an imbalance that is, I think, correlated to social and economic class in how long people have to stand in line. What is your observation about that?
Well, I certainly think it's true that certainly in 2004, the worst lines that you saw, for example, in Ohio, were happened to coincide with some sort of urban communities that were largely communities of color, as well as some more rural communities that happened to be where colleges were located, where the college student vote ended up waiting in line for 12 hours to be able to cast a ballot. Now, part of the problem there is one of funding. Sometimes the election administrators in big cities don't have the same kind of money that other suburban areas may have. So that's one issue. But I think another problem is that there are partisan election officials, unfortunately, that make some of the decisions to allocate resources to some of these communities. And unfortunately, I think they too often in the past have perhaps deliberately given short shrift to certain communities so that it's inevitable that there would be long lines there. Now, that's not to say that there has always been a partisan motivation for creating lines. Sometimes lines happen simply because of lack of preparation or for mundane things such as machines breaking down. Ohio, an example I just mentioned, where some of the stories of long lines were most prevalent in 2004. Ohio has actually, to their credit, passed some measures that will ensure that every polling place has emergency paper ballots that can be deployed in the event either of a machine breaking down or simply of turnout being so high at any given point that the lines really get long. So there are hardworking election officials that are trying to make sure that these problems don't happen again, and Ohio is an example of a state that's taken some good steps in that direction. Having said that, you know, long lines are not a technological problem. They're not a new problem. They are, unfortunately, a long-standing issue, and a lot of it just has to do with, again, as I said, allocating resources, making sure there are enough machines in different polling places and enough ballots available. And, for example, already, even in early voting, we've been seeing stories in the press of particularly long lines. Again, to go back to the example in Florida, you've seen people waiting in line 3, 4, 5 hours to cast a ballot in early voting. Now, that's a great sign of the enthusiasm people have in this election, and that's a great sign of the fact that people are engaged and want to make sure their votes count. But there's really no reason why this has to happen. Early voting as well as regular voting, the lines should be open early, they should be open late, they should be open for a long time, and they should have enough machines in every polling place so that these lines can get moved through quickly. Thankfully, going back to Florida today, actually, the governor of that state issued an emergency executive order that's going to extend the hours that the early voting sites are going to be open. So Governor Charlie Crist of Florida has done, I think, taken an important step in the right direction. But even so, we're going to see stories of long lines. It's pretty inevitable that that'll happen. We can hope, again, that they are as isolated and as limited as possible, but I don't think we should expect that there won't be any polling place across the country where they don't have some issues with a machine breaking down, running out of ballots, and that sort of thing.
We've got a few minutes left. There are two more issues that I wanted to see to you to address. One is voter identification. Are there any states that are requiring voters to present identification at this point, and what kind? And then the other is provisional ballots. Are they counted in the numbers that they should be once they're cast?
Well, those are two important, very important issues because they affect sort of voters at the beginning of the process and the end. On the one hand, the ID issue is making sure you can get to the polls and get given a proper ballot. And on the other hand, if you are not, let's say because you don't have the proper type of ID, you're not given a regular ballot and given a provisional ballot, what the odds are that is going to count. So turning first to the ID issue, to answer your question, there are, yes, there are voters that will have to give IDs in numerous states across the country. In a small number of states, they're going to have to give a photo ID. There was a lot of press earlier this year when the United States Supreme Court evaluated whether or not it was constitutional for the state of Indiana to require that every in-person voter present a government-issue current and valid photo identification. The Supreme Court said that in spite of the fact that that will inevitably stop some small percentage of people that don't have photo IDs from voting, it didn't violate the Constitution for the state to do that because the state had an interest in making sure people were showing up to vote, the people that were voting were who they said they were. So there are a few states like Indiana that require voters to show photo ID. Most states that require ID will accept a photo ID, but will also accept some range of other identification, pay stubs, bank account statements or utility bills, those sorts of things that prove a voter actually lives at the address they've registered to vote at and that sort of thing. Some states require every single voter in the state to provide ID. Some states only require first-time voters to show ID. Some states only require first-time voters who registered by mail. So there's a wide range of policies, and states are really beginning to experiment with these measures. The result in most of these states, if a voter does not have that sort of ID, is to force them to vote a provisional ballot. Now, as I said earlier in the program, a provisional ballot is better than no ballot at all, but all too often it is not an effective substitute for a traditional regular ballot because all too often those are not counted. The Pew Center on the States, which is a nonpartisan group, did a survey of provisional ballots that were cast during the primaries earlier this year. And they looked at all 50 states and tried to get a picture of how many provisional ballots were being cast, how many were being counted, and so forth. And what they found was that there is a huge, huge variety and wide range of different treatment of provisional ballots. Some states, up to 70% or more of these provisional ballots ended up getting tossed out without being counted. Now, I don't mean to say that they were literally just simply thrown in the garbage, but whatever the board charged with determining whether or not to count those ballots, whatever you call that, the canvassing board or the board of electors, decided with 70% of those just not to count them. Other states had basically the opposite where, 70% were counted and only 30% were tossed out, and then many other states kind of fell someplace between. And part of the reason for that is that there are different standards in different states for counting these ballots. Some states require that if you cast a provisional ballot, you have to, either within 2 days or 4 days or 10 days of the election, you have to make a trip to the county office and sign an affidavit that says you are who you say you are or show them some sort of identification. For other states, if you don't have your ID, you cast a ballot and you sign an affidavit right there on the envelope of the provisional ballot that says you are who you say you are and you're an eligible voter, and they go back and compare the signature on that affidavit with the signature you used when you registered to vote. And if the signatures match, your vote counts whether you make an extra trip to the election office or not.
Adam Skaggs, it's actually time to go, unfortunately, but I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Adam Skaggs is a lawyer with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. They can be found on the web at brennancenter.org. And for people who have any questions on Election Day or before, you can call toll-free 866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E. Adam Skaggs, thanks so much for spending all this time with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Lester Young. Broadcasting from the studios of KSFR, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.